So this health affairs study simply took the average results from all three states and extrapolated them to the entire nation without telling you that in the original study on which this was based, only one state, New York, actually demonstrated a statistically significant decline in mortality attributable to Medicaid. So this is equivalent to a doctor telling you that the blue pill will reduce your risk of death, even though two out of three patients in the clinical trials of that drug showed no benefit whatsoever. It's worse than that, since New York's Medicaid program ranks number 8 in the country, according to Public Citizen. The states where Medicaid had no apparent effect on mortality ranked number 13, Maine, and number 24, Arizona. Thus, most states that have not expanded Medicaid are much more likely to get results like Maine and Arizona's than New York's. That is, their characteristics are more similar to the patients who didn't benefit from the blue pill than the 1 in 3 patients who did. Moreover, we don't even have a lot of confidence that the apparent mortality benefit in New York even can be reliably attributed to Medicaid. The study did not measure actual mortality experience of people with and without Medicaid. Instead, it looked at county-level non-elderly death rates for all causes before and after Medicaid expansion, and then tried to make those counties as statistically comparable as possible. Taken at face value, the study implies that Medicaid expansion reduces external causes of death, such as injuries, suicides, homicides, substance abuse, by 50%. Now, it's not impossible for health insurance to reduce mortality risks due to such causes, but it seems highly improbable that Medicaid coverage would allow such causes of death to be cut in half. Yet that's what the study implies, if you believe the results at face value. But there's another good reason that the mortality reduction observed in New York might simply be a statistical artifact. New York was being compared to Pennsylvania, which OVIC has shown differed important ways by having a lower poverty rate and far lower rate of ethnic or racial minorities. Since Medicaid appeared to produce the biggest mortality gains among ethnic and racial minorities, it's easily possible that using a state more comparable to New York would have eliminated the apparent mortality gain that instead was attributed to Medicaid. Now, the second study that was used to predict that Medicaid expansion would save over 7,000 lives was even more flawed. The first problem is that this study actually estimated the mortality benefits of giving uninsured people private coverage, not Medicaid. OVIC has documented the huge body of scientific evidence that rather consistently shows that private coverage is superior to Medicaid, both in terms of providing access to care, but also improving health outcomes. It is wholly inappropriate to claim or imply that Medicaid expansion could achieve comparable results as private health insurance coverage. And unlike the quasi-experimental health affairs study, which compared two groups before and after Medicaid expansion, this study compared two groups at one point in time and then observed how many had died by a later point in time. Now, it tried to make the uninsured and those with private coverage as statistically comparable as possible, but it couldn't control for important factors such as drunk driving, speeding, failure to use seatbelts, etc. And on every metric of health risk that the study did look at, obesity, lack of exercise, smoking, and drinking, the uninsured live riskier lives than those with private coverage. So there's no way to decisively rule out the possibility that the apparent mortality gain from having private insurance instead results from these unmeasured differences in lifestyle. And not surprisingly, but disappointingly, the health affairs offers never tell you that there was a nearly identical observational study done with a sample nearly 70 times as large that showed no statistically significant difference in mortality for those with employer-based coverage compared to those who were uninsured. So the bottom line from where I sit is that I can state with great confidence that the Health Affairs study has grossly overestimated any mortality gains to be had from Medicaid expansion. The evidence that Medicaid even has a positive effect on adult mortality risk is far more thin than the single-payer advocates who wrote the study have led you to believe. The quasi-experimental results from the Medicaid expansion study from a scientific point of view are somewhat stronger than the observational results from the second study, but even as they relate to the single state where a statistically significant reduction in mortality was associated with Medicaid expansion, we cannot be certain that this result was genuine. And it's certainly inappropriate to extrapolate that one rosy result to states that are much more likely to have outcomes that are more similar to the two states where Medicaid produced no statistically significant improvement in mortality.
Thanks, Chris. Ovik, I want to bring you in here. Can you talk to us about your book, How Medicaid Fails the Poor? And can you give us your opinion on how someone can claim that Medicaid expansion saves lives when we know and a whole host of research tells us that health outcomes in Medicaid are so poor?
Well, let me just start by summarizing Chris's commentary in a less polite and more blunt way than Chris would ever do, because he's a gentleman. And that is this, that if anyone who makes the claim that Medicaid improves health outcomes is either not accurately or honestly representing the medical literature or doesn't know the medical literature. The medical literature is overwhelming on this point. It's overwhelming on the point that Medicaid, at best, doesn't improve health outcomes, and at worst, maybe slightly worse. So why is it? Why is it that that Medicaid does so poorly? I mean, intuitively, it makes no sense. We spend $450 billion a year on this program. How is it possible that with all that money, Medicaid performs so poorly on health outcomes? And that's the subject of this slim volume, How Medicaid Fails the Poor, which I published through Encounter Books, and it's like a $4.48 book. It takes an hour to read. It's really more like a long magazine article. I think it's very digestible for this audience if you're interested in learning more about these issues. And in there, I review some of the data that Chris talked about in his remarks. But let me try to do this. Let me try to explain it in a kind of a flow chart. Imagine if I was sitting in front of a screen and trying to describe a flow chart on a blackboard. And start with this. When the Medicaid program was designed in 1965, it was designed along highly ideological left-wing lines, which means you're paying for this program, and the poor are not expected to pay for any of it. In fact, the way Medicaid is designed, the beneficiaries of the program, it's required by law that the beneficiaries have minimal to zero financial obligations for their own care. It's effectively all free to the end user. The end user can't really have meaningful copays. The end user can't have meaningful deductibles. It's all paid for by the government. And so what has that resulted in? And the other thing, actually, I should mention about Medicaid is that it's jointly run, of course, as you all know, by states and the federal government. So those are the two key elements of the Medicaid design that are distinctive and relevant to this discussion. The first, that the poor are not expected to pay anything. The second, that it's jointly funded by the states and the feds. So how does that play out? Because the poor don't pay anything, they have no copays, no deductibles, nothing, there's almost no way to steer these individuals into more cost-efficient care. So for those of us who have private insurance, for example, if you have high cholesterol, if you get diagnosed by your doc for high cholesterol, the insurance company that the doc sends your prescription to is going to say, well, listen, if we start you off with a generic cholesterol-lowering drug, your copay is going to be $5, $10, whatever. But if you insist on having a branded drug that may be only incrementally better than the drugs that are generic today, then we're going to make you pay a copay of, say, $40, $50, whatever. Or we may not even reimburse for it at all. And in that way, insurance companies steer you towards more cost-effective less pricey care. In the Medicaid program, nobody can do that because the federal government prohibits, through this congressional statute, the ability of insurers or the government, the state governments, to run their programs in such a way that, for example, if you go to the emergency room, if you're on Medicaid and you go to the emergency room to get non-urgent care, the copay, in theory, in a private plan would be much higher than it would be for getting that care through a normal doctor. But the Medicaid program isn't allowed to charge you a meaningfully higher copay to go to the emergency room to get that care. So what happens? A lot of people on Medicaid go to the emergency room because they know they'll get treated right away. What has happened as a result of that? The Medicaid program has been over budget in every state. Now we pay that $450 billion a year because the beneficiaries of the program have no incentive to use the healthcare system efficiently because these copays and deductibles are fixed by law to be basically near zero. So what ends up happening as a result of that? States go over budget. They can't afford to keep funding the Medicaid program. The only things they're effectively allowed to do without much interference from the federal government is pay doctors and hospitals less money to provide the same amount of care. Everything else, like charging copays, is either prohibited expressly or it's blocked by federal bureaucrats at HHS. So the only thing politically and from a technical standpoint that and legally that states have really the easy way, you know, the thing about that squeaky wheel gets the grease, I mean, the squeaky wheel in this case is reimbursement rates for doctors and hospitals. So what states do is they cut back on what they pay doctors and hospitals to care for Medicaid patients, because that's the only way they can rein in costs. They can't ask poor people to pay premiums. They can't ask poor people to have deductibles. They can't ask poor people to have copays. So what's left? Basically, the only thing that's left is paying doctors and hospitals less to provide the same care. So over time, what's happened with that? With that decision by states, every year they crank back the reimbursement rates of doctors and hospitals. Doctors in particular have dropped out of the program. An increasing number of physicians don't accept Medicaid patients, and as a result, it becomes very, very difficult for Medicaid beneficiaries to get not only primary care, but specialist care. So there was a study a couple years ago that was published, I believe, in the New England Journal of Medicine and another in pediatrics that showed that if you were a child with a broken arm, about 60% of physicians who were specialists, orthopedic, pediatric specialists, wouldn't accept your insurance. Whereas if you had private insurance, almost everyone did. So if you had an acute asthma attack and you were a kid, a lot of doctors wouldn't take your insurance if you had Medicaid. So is it any surprise that if physicians don't take your insurance and won't see you when you have an acute medical problem, let alone just general physical check, annual physicals and primary care checkups, is it any surprise that the health outcomes would be worse? So the health outcomes are worse because people don't have access to care. The reason they don't have access to care is physicians don't take Medicaid. The reason physicians don't take Medicaid is because states have been rolling back how much they pay physicians to care for you. And on and on. And that, again, results from the fundamental design of the Medicaid program that goes back to 1965 and has never been changed. So, you know, we talk a lot in our circles about how Obamacare is unfixable and all this kind of stuff. The program that's the most unfixable in our healthcare universe is Medicaid. Medicaid is so broken that it basically can't be fixed. And this is the great danger of expanding Medicaid, is that, you know, if you expand Medicaid, you're not going to be able to reform it later. You're going to make it even harder to reform Medicaid because so many more people are going to be on that program and affected by any single thing you do to it to, say, increase the premiums or increase the copays or what have you, that it becomes even harder to reform. And it becomes even more of a pressure on state budgets and all sorts of other state-based priorities like education, policing, get squeezed. Because more and more money, more and more tax revenue has to be spent on Medicaid rather than other programs. So it's an incredibly dangerous decision to expand Medicaid, and it's been quite disappointing that so many Republican-controlled states have done so already. And we have to hold the line here because it's been, you know, the states that haven't expanded Medicaid thus far, they can be expanded at any time. And once that expansion goes through, it's going to be very hard to roll back. So it's very important that people don't lose sight of that and remain vigilant, because in the states that didn't expand Medicaid last year, there continues to be a push from the left to expand Medicaid this year, and they're going to have a couple of victories from what it looks like.
Remember that if you'd like to ask Chris or Ovik a question, you can press *6 to get into the question queue. But before we go to some of our live questions, I want to follow up on a few points. Ovik, you brought up emergency rooms, and I think there are some folks on the call that aren't familiar with the Oregon experience. Just a quick line about Oregon, for those of you who don't know, Oregon expanded Medicaid through a lottery system, which really allowed researchers to study the effect that Medicaid has on people's health. Ovik, can you talk about what happened in Oregon and what it can tell us about Medicaid, health outcomes, and emergency room use?
Well, I think anybody who's interested in learning about how Oregon has singularly destroyed its healthcare system should read Mark Hemingway's article in the Weekly Standard last week, where he describes from beginning to end how John Kitzhaber, who's now the governor of Oregon and was an emergency room physician as state representative or state senator in Oregon 20 years ago, has been primarily responsible for everything that Oregon has messed up regarding its healthcare system. One of the things they, of course, messed up was their Medicaid program. What they did was they expanded Medicaid back in the early 90s, when all the liberals were excited about Hillary Care. A number of enterprising Democratic policymakers expanded Medicaid as a way of achieving universal coverage. Of course, when Oregon expanded Medicaid, what happened? It massively destroyed their budget, because all of a sudden there was all these people signing up for it. There was all this spending that they didn't anticipate, and they had to pare back the program. And when they pared back the program, that's what created this, that's what ended up causing this lottery, is that they had expanded eligibility for the program but didn't have the funds to actually enroll everyone who wanted to sign up. So they created a lottery where, about tens of thousands of people would, if they won the lottery, they'd get Medicaid, and those that lost the lottery wouldn't get Medicaid. And some enterprising economists looked at this from MIT and Harvard and said, hey, this is a natural experiment that we can use to follow these patients over time and see if Medicaid is making a difference in their health outcome, precisely because most of the literature has shown that Medicaid doesn't improve health outcomes, and these guys wanted to show, these guys and gals wanted to show that, well, actually, no, Medicaid does help people, and this is our best chance to show, prove it. So they tracked these patients over time, the ones that didn't win the lottery and were uninsured, and those that won the lottery, quote-unquote, and got Medicaid, to see how they did. And what they found after 2 years, and again, and I'm sort of summarizing the story here, what they found after a two-year study was that Medicaid did not improve health outcomes. It didn't make patients live longer. It didn't improve their control of their diabetes, their high blood pressure, their cholesterol, nothing. And this was surprising to some of the researchers who were very optimistic about Medicaid's value. It wasn't surprising to those of us who are really familiar with the medical literature on this topic. And so it created this big firestorm. But I think it stands as the definitive argument in favor of our point of view, which is that Medicaid is not helping people, and if we want to offer people good health care, Medicaid is not the place to start, not the place to end, not the place we should be talking about this at all. And a second point that we should bring up with the Oregon study that comes from something that was published just very recently, which is this whole idea that, well, one of the principal reasons we need to expand Medicaid and expand coverage generally is because it will keep people out of the emergency room. Right now, people can get free coverage to the emergency room, and if they have Medicaid, they'll stay out of the emergency room, and that will save everyone money. Well, all the evidence, again, has shown that that isn't true. In Massachusetts, they found that for every dollar they saved in emergency room spending, they increased overall health spending by $3 to $4. So they were losing money net on this whole process. And in fact, the Oregon study found that when they expanded Medicaid, they dramatically increased the number of people who were using the emergency room for non-urgent care. So far from reducing emergency room usage by this population, it actually, the Oregon Medicaid expansion expanded the number of people who were inappropriately using the emergency room and costing the system more money. So this was another talking point from Obamacare and also from RomneyCare, it must be said, that was demolished by this Oregon study. And so it's just, again, this is a situation where the data and the facts are very, very much on our side and have been neglected, you know, by the left because they don't they want to ignore the data or massage the data or manipulate the data to show an effect or a relationship that it doesn't. One other point I want to make about Medicaid that that's sort of outside of this whole issue of health outcomes, something that's important to be aware of is that more than a third of the people who, quote-unquote, benefit or who would be the recipients of the Medicaid expansion are prison inmates. So it turns out that the Justice Department estimates that about 35% of the Medicaid expansion enrollees will be people who have are literally convicted criminals. That is the big, you know, one of the biggest chunks or subpopulations of people who will get coverage through Medicaid. Now, from a policy standpoint, we can have a discussion about what's the best way to reintegrate convicted criminals back into civil society, and maybe health coverage is something we need to think about along those lines. But it's important to understand that a big chunk of this population is not the nice single mom who was denied coverage because of a pre-existing condition and can't get coverage, and therefore Medicaid is a last resort. The big chunk of this population are people who are, again, convicted criminals who are getting coverage through Obamacare and in many cases doing so because taxpayers are footing the bill. I mean, taxpayers, of course, are footing the bill entirely for the Medicaid expansion in one form or another.
Yeah, Ovik, I think you're right. I mean, we hear a lot about who this population, who this Medicaid expansion population is, and it's not kids, it's not the disabled. They're already covered by Medicaid today. And to follow up on your point about people going to the ER even with Medicaid expansion, I think you'll see even the most left-wing Medicaid expansion supporters will agree that even if you do expand Medicaid, there's going to be a lot of education that needs to happen for these people in order to get them to go to the doctor if they can find a doctor that will take them rather than going to the ER. And there was something good in Kaiser Health News a few weeks ago about that. Chris, before we go to live Q&A, I want to bring up one point, and it's kind of a little in the weeds, but I think you can set us straight.
Okay.
We hear a lot about these studies that say Medicaid really leads to poor health, and expansion supporters counter, and they say, well, we're going to dismiss that research outright because, you know, the studies that you're citing don't control for things like whether or not someone is poor, whether or not someone can speak and understand English. All of these other factors might contribute to the fact that Medicaid leads to poor health outcomes, and it's not Medicaid itself. Can you talk about some of those criticisms?
Right. There's no question that observational studies generally are weaker evidence than the gold standard of scientific evidence, which is randomized controlled trials. That's what the FDA uses to approve drugs, for example. But expansion supporters have to be a little consistent. It's inappropriate to criticize observational studies as flawed whenever they show that Medicaid is worse than private coverage or even in some cases, as Ovik has shown, than being uninsured. But then turn around and rely on observational studies to support a claim that Medicaid expansion would save lives. And that's what the Health Affairs study did. Moreover, it's certainly true that observational studies cannot control for everything. So there always will be some unmeasured effects. But Ovik's done a great job of dissecting the massive Virginia Surgical Outcomes study of nearly a million patients. It's an observational study, to be sure, but it also was able to control for the lion's share of patient differences that reasonably could be expected to affect surgical outcomes. It's difficult to believe that any remaining unmeasured differences would have been large enough to account for the striking difference in mortality rates for Medicaid patients compared to those with private coverage or no coverage. Moreover, consistently finding that private coverage beats Medicaid in study after study accords a little more confidence that the health differentials that these studies are measuring are actually real and not a statistical artifact. Remember that for the longest time, the tobacco industry rebutted claims that smoking harms health using the very same criticism that everything was based on observational evidence. But of course, no IRB in the country would authorize a study in which people were randomized into smoking or into being uninsured. So while observational studies may not be the best evidence, they often are the only evidence available, and we shouldn't discount them as saying they offer no evidence whatsoever. The consistency of the finding that Medicaid is inferior to private coverage across study after study after study gives me, you know, some confidence that that's true, not a statistical artifact.
We're now going to open the call for questions. If you have a question, again, please press star 6 to be placed into the question queue. Again, that's star 6. We have a question that was sent in by a Virginia legislator, and the question is this. The Arkansas experiment is on the ropes, as I understand it. Can you send us the details on this situation? Arkansas is being used as an example in Virginia to push expansion. What do you think about the Arkansas model?
Yeah, so I've written a bunch of stuff on the Arkansas model, and if you just Google my name and Forbes and Arkansas Medicaid, you'll find it all. Right now, in fact, I was just talking to someone who's plugged in down there last night. Right now, the Arkansas legislature, which is controlled by Republicans, it has voted down a couple of times the appropriation for this Medicaid expansion, which was passed last year. The leadership, the pro-expansion leadership of the legislature has insisted they're going to bring this before a vote every day until the recalcitrant legislators buckle, or at least enough of them do, that the expansion will once again pass. So that process is ongoing. We'll see what happens there. And I think it's extremely important that, as a side note, that we marshal a lot of resources to try to defeat the expansion of Medicaid in Arkansas if it's possible. So what happened in Arkansas, and what makes it interesting? So actually, when I first heard about what was going on in Arkansas from some of the Republicans who were supporting it a year or two ago, I was intrigued, because what they claimed they were trying to do was basically say, look, instead of expanding Medicaid, we're going to give this Medicaid population exchange-based insurance. We're going to give them, just like someone who would enroll in the exchange today who was poor, we're going to give them the dollars and say, you know, using that voucher premium support payment, we, you know, shop on the exchange and find a plan that suits you. And to me, this was a massive improvement on the Medicaid approach, because, you know, what did I say were the big problems with the Medicaid approach? That you don't have these copays, you don't have these deductibles. And so if you're actually saying to someone, okay, we're going to give you the dollars, go buy insurance on the exchange, you know, in theory, what you're saying is you're going to give them normal private insurance, albeit, you know, Obamacare-regulated private insurance, but it's a massive improvement, relatively speaking, from the way the traditional Medicaid program works. Well, it turns out that pitch, that presentation of what Arkansas was doing, was not true. So what, in fact, HHS in Washington had said to Arkansas was, yeah, we'll let you, you know, create this kind of exchange window dressing around your Medicaid expansion, but you're going to have to adhere to the same copay and deductible and premium restrictions that the Medicaid program has always had. In other words, you know, yeah, you can use private insurers to deliver the Medicaid benefit, but the Medicaid benefit has to be the same Medicaid benefit it's always been. It can't be reformed and modernized to reflect the way normal private insurance works. And so once that became clear, and HHS published a letter where they described exactly how this would work and how it was, you know, a lot less than it appeared to be at first, I wrote about that too, and I said, well, you know, it looks like, you know, this was kind of a Lucy with the football thing where this is not a real, this is not a privatization of Medicaid. It's basically Medicaid with some quasi-private crony capitalist window dressing, and that's not at all what Arkansas should seek to do. And you know, that continues to be my position to this day. And I think it's really unfortunate that a number of states have now said, oh, well, look, Arkansas has done something in a bipartisan way with this private option. Let's do that. I think that's, you know, Pennsylvania is looking at this. I believe Iowa is looking at this. It's a number of states where, you know, again, they're competitive, purple states, we might say, where the Republican politicians there are feeling the heat from the hospital lobbies and other groups that are pushing hard for the Medicaid expansion, and they're looking to the Arkansas model as a way out. And I think that's been the unfortunate consequence of what's happened in Arkansas, is that because you have a Democratic governor in Arkansas and a Republican legislature, a lot of people who are looking for centrist bona fides can look at that and say it's a bipartisan approach that somehow meets in the middle. But no one should be fooled. This Medicaid expansion in Arkansas is in fact a Medicaid expansion and does not apply meaningful reform to the Medicaid program.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, press *6. We have a live question coming in from North Carolina. Go ahead with your question.
This is Marilyn Avila, and I'm a member of the House here in North Carolina. And the fact that we have a broken system, just about like everybody else, was our main reason for not expanding Medicaid. The question that I have is actually more curiosity, and there's a factor that intrigued me, and I wonder if it's not been discussed, and that was the payment. It was going to start out at 100% for 3 years from the federal government and then drop down to 90%. And I guess my question is, how have the states that have expanded their Medicaid planned ahead for that additional 10% in what was probably in their state a broken system? And do we trust Washington to keep it at 90% indefinitely?
Well, the short answer to your question is no, they haven't planned that much. Because basically what they've done, particularly the Republican states, the typical Republican state that has expanded Medicaid has handled it this way. They've budgeted for, you know, the next couple of years only, not for the long term. And over the next couple of years, of course, the federal government's covering the whole thing or nearly all of the Medicaid expansion. It's in the out years where the Medicaid expansion becomes more borne by the state governments, and those years tend not to be in the tables and charts that you get from the governor's office or from the budget organization in your state government. And so that's problem number one, is that people are only looking at the short-term fiscal benefit and not the long-term fiscal cost. The second thing that people have done is they've put in these triggers where they say, well, if the federal government were to ever reduce further the match rate from 90% to some lower percentage, then we would have a trigger that says the Medicaid program, the expansion is automatically suspended, and we would no longer participate. But that's completely unrealistic. So you're trying to tell me that, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 years into a Medicaid expansion, if Congress pulls the rug out from under you and stops funding the program at the same rate, the politicians in that state are going to throw hundreds of thousands of people off Medicaid? There's no history to suggest that politicians will do that once the entitlement has been fully entrenched. So I see those provisions as worthless, and I think it's really disappointing that Republican politicians have pointed to those provisions as some kind of assurance of fiscal stability of this program, because I don't think they'll serve that purpose at all.
Yeah, let me put one caveat on that. We actually do have historical experience, which is the 10-CARE program, which expanded massively. The state figured out it couldn't afford it, and then in one fell swoop, they knocked 350,000 people off the Medicaid rolls. I'm not sure that's I wouldn't want to be a state that's caught in that trap. And I agree with Ovik. There's no reason to suppose that the feds are going to be able to honor their promise to fund this at 90% in perpetuity. I mean, already there's discussions in Congress about changing that formula because of the budget pressures.
That's a great point.
I think you're right. I want to jump in real quick. Representative Avila, I think you'll see in a lot of other states that are debating Medicaid expansion, a lot of them in their legislation construct something like a taxpayer recovery fund where all of the upfront Medicaid money goes into this special lockbox for expansion, and that's going to be used to pay for cost overruns when FMAP drops below 100%. What you'll see in most, if not nearly all of those states, when they project out 10 years, when they project out to, 2030, 2025, the money in those taxpayer recovery funds will be gone. There's never going to be enough to pay for cost overruns in perpetuity in the future. I've heard other state legislators also point out that it's not going to be, they don't think that Congress won't fund Medicaid at all, but it's definitely possible that they're going to ratchet it down slowly, a couple of percentage points at a time, and, one percentage point and your Medicaid match in North Carolina might be, $1 billion. So it's going to be something we're going to be talking about for many, many more months to come. Chris, we had a question just come in over email from an Illinois state legislator, and he asked, didn't the mortality rate actually slightly increase following expansion in Maine? Yet these same Obamacare advocates are all saying that Medicaid expansion will do the opposite.
Well, it did increase slightly. That wasn't a statistically significant result. From the standpoint of a scientist, that's a null result, no impact one way or the other. But I would just say this about it. If we knew for sure that Medicaid had this definitive positive impact on health, wouldn't you expect to see it in all three states, right, and not just one state?
We have another email question. Oh, do we have a live question? Go ahead with your question. Looks like we dropped them. We had an email question from a state legislator in Mississippi, and they said statistics in Mississippi show that while there has been an increase in Medicaid services, there has been a decrease in the health of our Medicaid population. Is this a nationwide trend or one specific to states with poor health? Can either of you address that?
I cannot, but that's very interesting. It would be interesting to see if that's going on in other states.
Apologize. Which state was this?
Mississippi.
Yeah, I haven't looked at the Mississippi numbers directly. I'd have to take a look at that. I think one thing that's it also depends on how the state's Medicaid program was run before, what the eligibility criteria were before, and how that corresponds to how the exchanges interact with the Medicaid program. So all that would matter in thinking about that, but that is something worth looking into. I'll have to take a look at that.
Our final question comes from someone in Oklahoma, and they have a very blunt question. What is the truth? Why are my local hospitals so insistent?
Well, I wrote a piece for a National Review about this last summer called An Arm and a Leg. And it's all about how the hospital lobby is going bananas trying to lobby for this Medicaid expansion. It's very simple. It's the money. So for every dollar that taxpayers are forced to spend on government health care programs, 40 cents goes to hospitals. So hospitals stand to make an enormous amount of money from the Medicaid expansion, because all that extra health care, that spending goes, a big chunk of it, the largest chunk of it, goes to them. And they've been running around trying to claim that they're going broke because they're underpaid, et cetera, et cetera. They're not going broke. If you look around and you look at hospitals all over this country, they are building new wings, gleaming new towers filled with new equipment. because of all the money that the government and thereby taxpayers are spending on them. And this is going to be the biggest bonanza. Obamacare is the biggest bonanza for the hospital industry that's ever been seen. You know, I recently did a debate in Florida on Obamacare, and it was me and Steve Brill, who's a liberal who actually supports single payer, against two hospital executives, one who runs the Harvard-affiliated hospital group called Partners Healthcare, and another that runs a Pennsylvania-affiliated group called Geisinger. And those were the guys who are most pro-Obamacare because, again, for them, it's all about the money. They get enormous amounts of money. And you have to be very aware of how the hospitals have manipulated this whole debate. I think we have a tendency to think of hospitals as these, you know, these guys are helping people. They're the good guys. They're filled with people who are saving lives. Hospitals are big corporations that dominate. They're the biggest crony capitalists in America. There's more taxpayer money that's funded, that's directed towards hospitals than any other industry, including the military, the defense industry, in the country. It's about, I want to say it's like $800 billion of direct subsidies to the hospital industry from the government. So it's very important to be aware of that. They do a good job of concealing that image, but they are the biggest crony capitalists in the history of civilization, basically.
Chris, do you have anything to add to that very definitive final statement from Ovik?
No, I will just point out that hospitals have been pushing for Medicaid expansion since I arrived at Duke in the mid-1980s, so this is nothing new. Just more of the same, and Ovik's right, follow the money.
We're about out of time. Chris and Ovik, just one final kind of closing comment. If you were to put yourself in a state legislator's shoes and you're in a committee hearing and you're listening to someone tell you, Chris and Ovik, you are letting people die every day that you don't expand Medicaid, how would you respond?
I'd wave in their face a printout of the New England Journal of Medicine article showing that the opposite of that is true.
Chris?
Yeah, I would say that the evidence this is true is thin. In the best study that looked at this, 2 out of 3 states showed no effect on mortality. And so we're basing this all on one state, New York, where we're not even sure that that effect is a genuine effect.
Well, thanks to both of you, to Duke University Research Fellow Chris Conover, Forbes.com editor Ovik Roy, and to all of you who participated on the call today. If you're interested, you can join us next Friday, February 28th at noon Eastern. We'll be having another FGA conference call titled How Medicaid Expansion Hurts Seniors, and that will be with FGA Senior Fellow Josh Archambault. If you want to register for that call, again, next Friday, February 28th at noon Eastern on How Medicaid Expansion Hurts Seniors, please email us at info@thefga.org. We'll have a transcript of today's call posted at our website, uncoverobamacare.com. There you can access additional research and resources on Obamacare exchanges and Medicaid expansion. Thanks to everyone, and we'll talk to you again soon. Have a good day.